Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to Spotlight on this occasion. First of all, can I just remind you that no texting in the window, please, or questions until we've finished. And as usual, I'd very much like to thank Becky for all her work that she does behind the scenes for Spotlight, and to Dennis once more for recording the proceedings for us for archive purposes. This week I've got someone else from the UK for you to meet. I'm not too sure if you've spoken to him, because he doesn't come on a great deal, and when he does, he's usually hides himself away in Fiddler's Green. But it's Dave Thompson, a.k.a. Tomo. And Dave, can I just welcome you to Spotlight and thank you for being agreed to be interviewed. And I'd like to start by asking you where and when you were born, Dave.
Okay, Steve, good evening to you all. You were in and out a little bit there, Steve, but I got the gist of it okay, and hopefully I've got a fairly decent contact with you all. Oh, God, I entered this planet on 1947, 9th of December.
And whereabouts were you born? Whereabouts in the UK are you from?
I was born in Manchester in 1947, 9th of December.
Okay, and your parents, what did your parents do for a living?
Okay, Steve, yes, they were both in the Royal Air Force. My dad was a pilot in Bomber Command, Coastal Command, and my mum was in the Royal Air Force. She was a WAF.
Can you tell us a little bit about the area in which you were born for the people in America? Because I'm familiar with your location. But just for our overseas listeners, just tell them a little bit about the area in which you live, what it's actually like.
Okay, Steve, and good evening to everybody out there, especially the other side of the pond. Yes, well, as I say, I was born in Manchester, about 8 miles outside of Manchester, in a suburb called Davyhulme, Ermston Davyhulme, and it's sort of typical English suburban area, very sort of quite close to an industrial part of Manchester called Trafford Park, which was quite a hive of industry in those days. It still is, by the way. And the only other things that flowed sort of or came through this part of Manchester was the Manchester Ship Canal, which is to the north and the west of the area. And, of course, as you know, that was a lot of shipping came up the Manchester Ship Canal to the port of Manchester in those days, of course. It's gone now. So we're fairly close to the Cheshire countryside. If you want to look at the old borders, it's the Lancashire and Cheshire border in those days. And we're very close to the sort of Cheshire countryside, which is very nice, because it's not far to go into the city. And it's not far to go into the countryside. A majority of the people in those days, of course, were either worked in the city of Manchester or they worked in the Trafford Park industry, estate, a lot of different industries going on. And I'll just put it back to Steve, just in case you want me to elaborate on that.
That's fine, Dave. And Manchester is in the northwest of England, isn't it? And of course, it's famous for one or two things, isn't it? Notably, the football team of Manchester United, I think, which is a world famous soccer team, and that's your home team, I take it.
Yeah, sorry, Steve. Manchester is in northwest UK, Manchester Liverpool area. If you were to look at the map of the UK, we're to the west side. That's where I can put it, west of the, you see Manchester, Liverpool, and if you look on the map and see Liverpool and Manchester, where it's actually written, that's sort of in between the end of the M and the middle of the O in Liverpool, so to speak, if you can get a rough idea.
Okay, thanks, Dave. That just gives people a little bit of a feel for the area in which you're living. Have you got any brothers and sisters?
Okay, Steve. No brothers and sisters. I'm the only one, which is can be fortunate and unfortunate, depends on how you look on life. And by the way, for those guys stateside, I'm about 50 miles from the coast. And the nearest, as most people know in here, the nearest sort of coastal resorts from us are Blackpool, Southport and so on.
Okay, Dave, thanks for that. You said a few minutes back that you were born prematurely. Does that mean that you've always had a sight problem?
Yes, Steve. Yes, I was. I'm 6 months. I was born under 6 months, and I was, yes, born prematurely. I was only 2 pounds at birth in 1947. That was quite a thing. So I'm told by my mum. And that caused retinal endophthalmic aplasia, or RLF, as our friends stateside call it. And yes, I have had sight problems, which we obviously want to go into later.
So, have you always been totally blind from birth, or did you have some residual vision for a little while?
Okay, Steve. Yeah, I had some. I've had residual vision for quite a few years, which I'll probably go into depth later on, unless you want me to go into it now, regarding the schooling and everything else sort of thing. But apart from the retinal endophthalmic aplasia, which I, of course, was born with, as those of you guys who have got it will know, which caused, as I say, fairly heavily burning to the retinas. As regarding brain damage, you'll have to ask the wife that one. Hi. But I was fairly lucky, but I can elaborate on that later on if you wish.
Okay, we'll come on to that a little later on. So, what are your early childhood memories of living in the Manchester area in the late 40s and early 50s? Say preschool, Dave, what can you remember about that period in your life?
Yeah, okay, Steve. Well, a lot of the time, of course, I was going back and to South Wales, which my dad came from Port Albert in South Wales, and my mum was originally from North Wales. And when my mum and dad moved up into Manchester, and my dad got a job working for Rolls-Royce, I went to a sort of mainline school, infants from junior school, in an area actually not too far from where I live now, in the area of Stretford in Manchester. And those of you who are football fans or are interested in football, I'm about 2 miles, 2.25 miles maybe from where the Manchester United ground is. Perhaps those of you who are interested in football will get an idea more now where I live.
What sort of a family life did you have, Dave? Were your parents protective of you, or were you allowed to get into all sorts of mischief like most young kids?
Ah, no. That's an interesting one. Of course, as most of you can imagine, of sort of only ones. My dad, of course, one of the main things he wanted me to do, of course, was get big enough to play rugby union. At that particular time, remember, I hadn't had the rest of my eye, well, tragedies if you want, like detached retinas and all the rest of it, which I'll tell you about later on. But, I bummed around with the rest of the kids. It was when I'd been perhaps in infant school and junior school, they started to realise that I had a sight problem that was really going to impair my education. But I'll put it back to you because I don't know how far you want to elaborate on that.
So you were going to ordinary, as we'd term it, area sighted school for a short period, were you? How long did that last?
Basically up until 9, 10 year olds, when it was, of course, realised that my sight was not helping my education. It was then they moved me from an infant stroke junior school of a sort of a mainline sort of teaching to a school for visually impaired children.
And you did actually go to a school for visually impaired children, did you, eventually?
Oh yes, I went straight away. They acted quite quickly. And of course, I don't think, of course, they weren't as worldly wise as they are today. And then I don't think we were typecast more in those days. And it was a nice relief to me that when I was the first week into this new school and this new class where everybody was the same as me, it was great, you know, and it was fantastic, because I was obviously it was only a great lesser degree of number of pupils in the room, and the people were far better trained. I'll keep these short, and then you can sort of, we'll see how it goes, so I don't break up.
Okay, I'm just a little bit confused at the present time, Dave, as to whether it was a residential school for the blind or a unit within your ordinary school situation.
Yeah, I do apologise, gang, for not making it clear. Yes, this was a class for visually impaired in a standard mainline school. They thought it was quite a progressive idea, and that's what it was.
Okay, that's a little bit unusual, isn't it, for that period, because now it's commonplace to send blind children to sighted schools and give backup. But in those days, which were probably, what, late 50s, very early 60s by now, it must have been rather unusual.
Yes, well, hang on, let's work it out. It was 61, 62, hang on, 1947, I went to this school, that's 1951, 11 years old. Yeah, probably about 61, 62. And this particular class started off as a pilot scheme to see how they would go on. And they did very well to get sort of two or three volunteer teachers that had taught it. Obviously, we didn't have the equipment like we have today. And of course, the one or two teachers had to cover all the subjects, which was not easy going.
I can imagine. Were you taught Braille at this time, Dave?
No, Steve. No. Well, we were not taught Braille at that particular time. But for funds and for with it being new, of course, they were. It was difficult getting money to even get simple things like large magnifiers, simple sort of things which we take so much for granted these days, just weren't available. And basically it was just a case of, there were, if we had 15 students in the class, maybe two of them, if they thought it was necessary, they would either go on to other units. So some of them would go to Henshaws and places. And at that particular time, of course, we sort of very much in between two goalposts. Not an easy thing to. You either could see something or you couldn't see anything. They weren't sort of. They didn't have the awareness they have today.
Yeah. So, when you were at school, were you academically gifted? Did you take lots of exams? And did anyone suggest any career which you may like to pursue?
Oh, that was the question at the time. Apart from, of course, your main subjects, and of course, I think we've all got some gifts. To cut a long story short, when it came to me leaving school, I had enough behind me to either go for A, I was going to go for physiotherapy down to Torquay. But somebody came up with the idea, and I'd fancied this, going to agricultural college. Don't forget, at that time I had more sight than I've got now. Let me emphasise that. I had more sight then than I've got now. So I sort of thought, okay, fine, I'll go to agricultural college and I'll see what I can get out of that. And I left school when I was 16. I stayed on, and from there I went to agricultural college in Derbyshire. That proved to be, if I want to be totally honest about it, not very successful. I enjoyed it and I loved what I was doing, but the problem is that as it went along there were certain aspects of the job that I knew that I wouldn't be able to sort of perhaps fulfill. So, even though it was part of my life I enjoyed and it's gone really well, by the end of it, there are only certain fields of agriculture that I could have gone in for.
They seem very strange bedfellows, Dave. Physiotherapy and agricultural college. I wouldn't have put those two together in a million years. What were you hoping to do when you left agricultural college if you'd pursued that?
Yeah, okay, Steve. Yes, I know, the same thing. But don't forget, we are going back to what? 50s, 60s, when really it was a case of trying to put you somewhere. And I suppose in a way I would have gone into animal husbandry and research. That's what I'd like to have done. And to be perfectly honest, I got a couple of places and I enjoyed it for a while, but I wasn't comfy. I wasn't happy in it, apart from the salary being absolutely rubbish and God knows what else. I just didn't think that I would have stuck it for as long as I would have hoped to get into it, so to speak. But I eventually decided that this wasn't for me.
When you decided it wasn't what you wanted to pursue, how did you progress then? What was the next step?
Well, in the meantime, Mr. Fate came along and smacked me with a detached retina. And we had to hold horses for a while this detached retina was sorted, which, of course, in those days, don't forget, no lasers, no none of the gear that we have today had to be done manually, even though in Manchester, of course, we've got the Manchester Royal Eye Hospital, which has a fantastic reputation. They operated on my right eye to do the detached retina, but it was a failure. And I'm going to cut a long story short now, I eventually ended up losing that eye.
So are we right to assume then at this point you were totally blind? Did you get that, Dave? So at this point, are we to assume that then you'd lost your sight totally?
Yeah, sorry, Steve. I lost quite a bit of that question. I just got a bit about losing my sight totally. No, I still had the left eye, which carried me along for for many years. It still does to a degree, which I shall get around to afterwards. So I ended up not actually losing the right eye at that time, as such. Visually wise, of course, it was gone. It was still mine, so to speak. I then went on and tried one or two other things, which I was into at the time. I had enough vision then to do one or two jobs that I thought I'd be interested in, work that I'd be interested in. Many years I've been very interested in shipwright stuff and sailing and so on and so forth. But I still had enough vision then to do that. And then it started to hit me that of course, in those days, to employ a visually impaired person, of course, it's not the same as today. And I remember going for an interview for this particular job. I'm just going to stop for a moment so that I don't get a memory problem in this machine. Hang on. Yeah, okay, right, we've still got it. Yes, I still had the left eye. That's a new one. The left eye had about 50% of vision in it, I'd say, at that time. 50% of vision. So I was getting around okay. There was no problem, to a degree. Still having to look close at things and so forth. So I was coming across the thing now where I'd go for an interview for a job. This particular job was for a marine equipment, dealing with people that were interested in marine sailing, boating and so on and so forth, and I had the experience because I'd worked on narrowboats and things, but that's another story, I'll tell you about that afterwards. I'm trying to get to this interview, which is always stuck in the back of my mind, that I went to this interview, I had the experience, I had the, at that particular time, we might call it the gift of the gab, and I had the knowledge of the materials required to do the job. the manager said, great, Dave, well presented, smart, that sort of thing. Just want you to talk to our other director. The other director came in, she says, yes, just that and the other. And then she turned around and said, well, I'm very sorry, Mr. Thomas, but I don't want to really employ you because I think you'd embarrass the customers. And I said, why? Well, she said, with you looking close at the paperwork, we think you'd embarrass them. And that was the first time it came home to me, I think, as regarding the job stakes.
Yes, that would rather be like a slap in the face, wouldn't it, after you'd, you know, decided that's what you wanted to do and what you wanted to pursue. So how did you handle it, Dave? What did you do? Did you decide to pursue another avenue?
Well, apart from coming out of there feeling totally pissed off, if you don't mind me, I do apologise for using that phrase, but I was at the time thinking, of course, they wouldn't get away with it today. But I thought, this is absolutely crazy. But of course, this is the way things were at that time. So, fair enough. Sort of shrugged it off and thought, one way or another. I remember my old fella coming to pick me up in the car, and he says, you look a bit peed off, what's the matter, how do you go on? So I told him, you see. So he said, oh well, don't worry about it then. And I then decided to start to take an interest in other things, and one of them was communications. And what I decided to do was to, in between sort of going around, I did one or two little jobs in horticulture. I think that was perhaps a spring off from the agricultural days. I did a few little jobs in there. In the meantime, I got interested in electronics and communications. And at that particular time, my left eye was still, you know, it was still keeping me going. I was still able to read and write standard sort of, with, of course, the right magnification and so on. But what had lingered along with the rest of the eye complaint, of course, was RLF caused a certain amount of muscular weakness, which had plagued me all my life, but didn't really bother me. And that was sort of affecting me from time to time, which I didn't really take a great deal of notice of. And as I went from sort of two or three jobs in all sorts of different sort of ones, really, jobs that I wouldn't sort of really bother you with about, I then decided to become a radio arm, and I took my examinations, and I then realised that I had a bit of a sort of event for that sort of line of work, and got into electronics. I then decided the job came up in health service, which I decided to take. By the way, by this time I was married, and I think our number one son was on the way, maybe number two son, I'm not sure, I can't remember that. And I got into this line of work. I'll just put it back to you, Steve, because I don't know if I'm going to overrun this memory problem.
Okay, Dave, no problem. You were solid to me then. So you say you took an interest in electronics, and I know that's the career you actually ended up pursuing in the end. Tell us a little bit more about this job which became available in the health service.
Yeah, well, what started out as a sort of a career-wise was a bit of a pain in the bum, really. I'd not really sort of found anything that I could get my teeth into as such, even though I'd tried really hard and worked hard and done as much studying as I could for what I wanted to do. I then decided that if I was going to stick with something, and this time I was married, I'd had a couple of jobs, and I was beginning to sort of, by this time, I met quite a few people, and this is where my luck started to change, actually. I'd met a few people in the radio amateur circles, which introduced me to other people that allowed me to get onto courses and things. A job came up in the health service, maintenance-wise, basically a bit of a dog's body and doing one or two jobs here and there and sort of pottering about. That came up, I'll have a go for that. And when I was there, I bumped into a guy one day, and who happens to be my boss, who's a radioman. He said, by the way, Dave, he said, I hear you've got your radioamateur ticket. I said, yes. He said, I also hear that you're doing a course at Trafford College on the electronics. I said, yes. He says, as a pal of mine who's a lecturer there, and we've rigged up some low visual aids for me. Oh, he says, have we? I said, yes. He says, sir, can you come and see me in the office tomorrow? He says, because we're looking for a new technician. We want to train him ourselves. So I thought, yeah, okay, fine. You know, didn't think a great deal of it because, as you say, my career prospect up until then had been a bit, excuse me, gang, but it's been a bit shitty to say the least. But I went along to see him and he interviewed me and he says, right, so what I'm going to do is I'm going to introduce my colleague and I'm going to put you through some tests. And basically it was what I knew about the job. I had the REE, which is a radio amateur exam. I had Sitting Gills electronics, and I was just about to do my third year in electronics, which if it hadn't have been for the college and the tutors and a bit of, I must admit, guys, it was a case of I just happened to meet the right people at the right time who organised all this for me. And perhaps I looked really miserable, so I thought, oh, well, give this guy a bit of a chance, you know how it is. And then I was introduced to a person who was working for a trust called ICAM. Not UCAM, but this is ICAM. And they were a trust that supported people, disabled people, in work. Just let me take a break, just in case I'm overlapping.
No, you're okay. Carry on.
Okay, cheers, Steve. Yeah, I was just making sure that I wasn't overlapping and sort of waffling and nothing. And she said, look, Dave, she came and interviewed me and we discussed how things were going on. By this time, by the way, guys, I'd lost my right eye completely. It had turned into a cataract, it had turned into a boil. They had to extract it because I was in a hell of a mess. And while I was going through this change, my left eye, because it was trying to make up for the mess my right eye was in, the muscles were getting weaker on the right hand side. That's the nose side, of course, of my left eye. And this was then making the oscillation, because this oscillation problem I had with the left eye, due to the weakness. It was causing what I call this fade out, which I'll go into again later. So, they had a meeting at work, and they decided to take me on as a trainee technician in those days. And I carried on at North Trafford College, which is here in Manchester. Bob and Chris, that's my colleagues who I work with now, they took me under their wing. And all right, I'm probably the first one to admit it was a touch of the old pals, that we're all radio hams together. And part of the job at time, of course, in those days the equipment was slightly older, so we had to be sort of fairly into and sort of have the knowledge of TV equipment and scan equipment and so on and so forth. I can elaborate on that if you wish, but. I was then in the situation, A, I was being trained up, B, I'd been taken under by ICAM, which was then taken over by Shaw Trust. Now, these are the people who were my other bosses at the moment in time. I shall tell you about that later. I'll just leave it there for the moment, Steve, just in case you wish to ask me anything else.
So, after this initial training you had, you were trained as a technician, and then eventually, I imagine, you took up a post at the hospital. Can you tell us the sort of equipment you were dealing with in those days, Dave, and what your job was, or still is?
Okay, Steve. Yes, well, I was just a medical electronics technician class one then, and for a great deal of the time, the authority decided that if we were going to set up a decent medical electronics lab at Trafford General, we wanted another technician for a start off. A lot of the people that were coming in really were from outside and sort of had not been trained in medical or physics type matters, which of course I at that time was being trained up into. The authority then by this time had fully understood my capabilities, and I was monitored every 6 months. And with the help of a very good grant, I got three overhead, very high quality, very good high visual aid, low visual aid cameras, which allowed me to magnify everything that I worked with onto a 21-inch TV screen or monitor, so I could fill the screen with a very tiny component and work on it. Of course, that was in those days. These days, of course, is a completely different state of affairs, which I can tell you about in a moment. So I carried on, beavered away on some, you know, most of the mundane bits and pieces that came in that particular time. Medical electronics, of course, these days is very sophisticated, and it's branched out into all sorts of different fields. But I filled in the post of the sort of go-getter, tester, come occasional repairer, come this sort of thing, as I was being trained up. Then we decided to branch off, and that's when I became a medical technical officer, which I am now. And we then went into other things. I'll just put it back to you, Steve, and if you wish me to tell you the things we branched out into, I will do with pleasure. By this time, by the way, I'd given up the right to go looking for a job of work for myself. If you wish me to elaborate on that, I will do.
Yes, but just before you do that, Dave, I'm fascinated with how you would, as a visually impaired person, cope with the job of soldering, using soldering irons and stuff like that, and circuitry, how you knew the circuitry of the equipment you were working with, and that sort of thing. I'm curious, and also the actual equipment you were actually servicing. What sort of thing are we talking about? X-ray machines, or medical instruments, or what sort of things were you dealing with?
Okie dokie. Okay, Steve. Well, don't forget. Remember that I still had 50% of vision in my left eye. And, of course, with the equipment, I could see circuit diagrams that were blown up onto the large screen. The tip of a very fine soldering iron, if you put it on, those of you who've got some vision, can see the little globe that's next to my name on the screen. The tip of my soldering iron would probably be as big as that. I've got a wobble on at the moment, so I can't see it, anything at all. I'm totally blind at the moment. And it's just about coming back again now. I can just about see the little bubble that's next to my nickname. So, of course, with me sort of being electronically minded, by this time, of course, because I had the RAE, I was still at college, so I knew circuitries. The tests required and the repairs required at that particular time were getting easy, because a lot of the equipment that was coming in was very much specialised. We do not deal with X-ray equipment. We do not deal with ventilators. My particular task is dealing with respiratory equipment, pain relief equipment, infusion pumps, and quite a few other things that I could go into if necessary. The time of soldering components in, Steve, I must admit, I don't think I've soldered a component in now for the last 5 years. Not because, of course, of the visual problems, because modern technology has become so sophisticated now. Of course, we've got double-sided PCB boards, we've got surface-mounted components, where we couldn't do anything if we wanted to, so they get sent away. Of course, this has happened. This has been a twofold thing, really. A, it's been better for me, because A, of course, the eyesight was getting worse due to this muscular problem, and B, we're becoming more board change jockeys these days, so a lot of the stuff we can put on test and so on, which is, of course, easier to do. You still need a background and you still need the knowledge, but at that particular time, I was only using servicing pumps, servicing infusion pumps, servicing pain relief equipment, TENS, enuresis, all sorts of stuff. I can elaborate on that if you wish.
Okay, Dave. You said a few minutes back that you'd, I think the phrase was you used was stopped looking for a job yourself, or some such wording, which obviously got me curious. Can you tell us what you actually meant by that? Because, of course, you were doing a job, but did your circumstances change in that direction?
Yes. Now, what happened, Steve? Now, this is very interesting. You guys out there, I thought about this quite a lot. When Shaw Trust, the actual job of work, whatever my sort of career I'm in, comes under a sheltered employment scheme. Now, those of you stateside will think of, from what I've spoken to those guys I've spoken to over the other side of the pond, it means just a little bit different over here. These days, of course, what with, I think the word I'm looking for is equal rights and so on and so forth. When I came under this particular umbrella, it meant that I gave up looking for a job in the workplace myself. Reason number one was my disability. Reason number two is, of course, that I could go and look for a job outside and I could get into a wrong job, a wrong employer, wrong type of work, totally unsuited, both for myself and a future employer. And that's the last thing we want. This meant that if I ever became out of work, if I ever came out of work, sorry, in the future, they find me work appropriate to my current skills. And this has been the great godsend. So it means that there are visually impaired people out there, or disabled people of any disability, that they will look for a job that suits them, they will find an employer that suits them, and they suit the employer. So there are no mismatches. I've been extremely lucky. I only work with two other guys. We're a great team. They're understanding. We've had some great times, both in getting round problems I've had visually wise for different parts of the job of work I do, which I can explain later if you wish. So that is it. It means what it says. It's a sheltered employment where I carry on a professional job that I do, a responsible job, and I am watched over, and not only that, they supply a good deal of the funding, including half of my salary.
Is this an initiative set up by RNIB? Is it their part of their small business setup or sheltered employment, or is it just in your particular area with your health authority? Who are your employers?
Oh no, Steve, it's all over the country. Shaw Trust is actually based down in the Midlands. And they've got quite a few of us bods now under their protection, so to speak. And I do liaise with the RNIB, and I also liaise with the Help at Work. There's a unit attached to the job agencies in Manchester called Help at Work, and they are there purely providing equipment and help for disabled people in the job place. So I've got Shaw Trust that support me financially and of course legally and all the rest of it, and I've got the Help at Work people who will come along and say, right Dave, do you need a new camera for this, or do you need a particular piece of equipment that will help you in your job of work, like software for my computers, like of course whether it's yours or whether it's, in my particular case, whether it's Zoom Text, any low visual aids, they will supply that. So it's a two-pronged assistance, one from the Help at Work team and the other one from Cure Trust, who sort of help me financially, salary-wise, and make sure that I'm not being sort of abused.
That's very interesting there. Thanks for that explanation. With you working in a hospital and working for in a medical environment, do you think that the fact that you are blind or visually impaired, shall we say, has helped the rest of the hospital to understand the problems of people with sight loss?
Yes, it's one of my pet interests, is because over the years, of course, we've all come across these things regarding how we're treated in the workplace, or anywhere in life, anywhere really. Since the last two or three years, I think, I've probably been too busy working to notice, and those people around me are either extremely polite, or, of course, they know the situation and don't say anything. But I tell you when this came over to me, a couple of years ago, when this wobble started to get worse, and I went to see my doctor, and at that particular time, my Phil, bless her, she'd had a stroke, only a mild one. She's perfectly okay now and bossing me about as usual, and I was at a rather low ebb. I went into the docs and the quacks, and he says, "How are you going on, Dave?" And this, that, and the other. He says, "Why are you not using your cane?" And, I said, "Oh, well, this, that, and the other." He says, "Look, you've had a cane for years." He says, "Why don't you now go from your symbol cane to a guide cane and get cracking? Admit to the world that you are no longer, you know, you've just got to get on with it like you're so used to doing." And he gave me a bit of a good old talking to, you know, a Dutch uncle chat sort of thing. And I said, okay, fair enough, you know, I know the score, I'm a realist, I get on with it. And I then started to use my guide cane every day, and I realised that the things I were avoiding, and really a danger to myself at that particular time, it started to click in that I'd been a bit of a fool, a very stubborn fool, I hasten to add. And excuse me, gang, it's not easy to admit this, but I'd been a bit of a plonker one way or another. I'd sort of got on with it and beavered on with it, and it's like declaring to the world that, okay, this is it, this is me now, I can no longer see, I have to use my guide cane, this, that, and the other. I was still Dave, I was still doing my job, I still had the gear to do it with, and I met some really odd results. Some of it was great, some of it was patronising, and some of it was bloody annoying, to be honest.
So, it took you all that length of time to admit to yourself that you got a visual problem. Did people treat you differently in the hospital, your actual work colleagues, when you decided to say, okay, I've got a problem and I'm going to admit it?
No, I'd always, of course, been very, very much aware, I couldn't ignore it really, that of the visual problem. I think it's sort of, well, all my pals, everybody, you know, all my friends, relations, you know, accept the fact that Dave can't see properly, and you just take it for granted. It's like sort of really sort of going public on something, and even though people know, and I know that they know, when you've got to fly the flag, so to speak, it was a tremendous relief in some respects. I say this to Phil many a time, and I think that I've got the way now where people see me thundering around the place, you know, with a guide cane in one hand and a bit of gear in the other hand, and I just carry on as normal. And people now, I think to myself, well, Dave, you were a real fool sort of thinking those things. You could have done it years, quite a while back, and not been... not been so silly. I went in to see my boss, this is the big boss, and I decided to sort of How are you going on, Dave? What's happening here? He says, great. He says, see you using your cane. Good, good. He says, you got to watch. He says, at least now that, from an insurance point of view, he says, I was going to mention it to you, but I didn't like. Oh, I says, like if I knock some old lady over that just come out of X-ray and this kind of white coat goes banging into her. And, you know. But those, of course, things have changed now. I've altered my job to sort of, I don't do as much charging about as I used to do. And those sort of jaunts that I do go on are, I make sure that I'm not in anybody's way. I'm feeling a lot more comfy with myself. And it's a silly thing, I know, even though I've been visually impaired all my life. And now, of course, I've sort of got to use the use my guide cane, use everything at hand, use everything I need, because, of course, the visual side of my life has deteriorated. But as long as I can carry on my job of work, not as fast as everybody else, of course, and this is the beauty of the sheltered employment, you can take as long as you want to do your job of work without sort of being in any fear of reprisal, so to speak.
Yeah, that's fully understood. And just as we begin to wrap up the interview now, Dave, can I ask you, do you ever foresee the day when, because of the advances in technology and electronics, that your job won't be there for you to do? Can you foresee that day?
Yeah, okay, Steve. In fact, if it wasn't, you know, it's a funny game this, but if it wasn't for the advances in technology, as in A, computers, none of us would be here tonight doing what we're doing now because of computer technology being what it is. My job of work I wouldn't be able to do, of course, because my three computers in the lab wouldn't be waffling away at me, databases telling me what equipment's due for servicing, what I'm servicing, and this, that, and the other. Modern electronics and cameras and high vision equipment that talks to you, tells you sort of voltages, currents, and all the rest of it. All these things are here to help us, and I think we should make use of them. As regarding my job of work, good God, no. We still need to keep the human factor. We still need for research, for tests, for application especially, to use equipment on certain things, for certain aspects, for certain people, for certain patients, and for certain illnesses and so on. All these things need to be worked on for medical technology. For ourselves, anybody with retinal fibroplasia, anybody with oxygen saturation that's gone through this problem, we're still working on those things. These days, of course, with twins, if twins are born, we still have to monitor them, both of them, very much, very, very closely. So it's all an ongoing thing. I just hope that perhaps this little interview tonight has perhaps given somebody an idea that to help them in some way, and it's not been a waste.
No, it certainly hasn't been a waste, Dave. It's been very interesting. And just let's end on a more personal note. You said earlier that you were married to Phil, and you got at least one child that you said. Have you got any more children? I suppose they're growing up now, are they, Dave?
Oh, yes. Got three sons. The eldest lad, he's 34, Mark Merlin. Number two son, Mark, he's 31 now, Mark. And young Darren, he's 25. Yes, three sons, and they're great. They're all supportive. Phil has been great. She's at one time when I was waiting for an operation in London to have the cataract removed, I was totally blind, completely blind altogether. She was my sort of stand-in, and if I was doing a job for somebody, she would come with the Allen keys and the screwdrivers and bits and bobs, and I would talk her through it, and it was great time. Brought us together. Great bonding. It really is great. And Yeah, it's nice. I'm very lucky to have a good family life and a good social life. And I think the best thing is openness. And I think a trouble shared is great. It doesn't matter who it is, like being back home in South Wales, if you tell somebody you've got a problem, by the time the evening's come, it's all around the village, it's no longer a problem.
yeah, I can just imagine. And you did tell me the other day, just briefly, for leisure, sometimes you hop aboard your friend's helicopter and go for a whiz round, don't you?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. My colleague at work, Chris Skidmore, a great guy. And he's just as much a friend as a work colleague. He's sort of the guy that comes up with these wacky ideas to help me to do jobs, like putting a simple thing, like in the early days we were having a problem with doing a test on certain infusion pumps. We had to run a liquid through an infusion pump. We run it through a column, but of course I couldn't see it. So I think, oh, this is no good. Dave's up the creek here. The following day, Chris is in the lab, he's beaving around with all these little bottles and things, and he comes up with his vegetable dye. I says, Chris, what on earth are you doing? He says, ah, big breakthrough, he says, Dave. I says, what's that? He says, vegetable dye. I says, yes, you're going to do us a soup for dinner? No, he says. And he put this vegetable dye in a giving set, and we ran this vegetable dye through the giving set, and it was brilliant. It was just all these kinky coloured sort of liquids flowing through, you see. So we had blue for one, green for another, and all. It was great. So I could see what we were doing. These sort of things, I think, us mad lot come up with.
ingenious. And he's the guy with the helicopter, is he?
Yeah, sorry, I got sidetracked. It is Chris. He's been a helicopter pilot for quite a while. And he's now flies out of Barton Airport, which is quite close to us at in Davidhulme in Stratford here. And he's not short of a few bob, and when he decides to go flying, I go with him. And we look for an hour at a time. He flies Enstrom helicopters. And because I've sort of, over the years, he's been training and sort of to become a helicopter pilot, I've gone through it with him and all those, so it's been great fun. And I've got about 15 hours in now, up with him, sat in the dummy seat, by the way, gang, sat in the dummy seat. And the other week, for the first time, I actually got to hold the stick and do a couple of little turns. And I was over the moon. I was too busy to be scared.
Well done, Dave. Well done. Anyway, that's just about it, I think, unless there's anything else that you'd like to share with us. Just before we finally wrap up, Dave, is there any other aspect or point or part of your life you'd like to share with us?
Yes, if you wouldn't mind, Steve, there's just one or two things that I've been lucky, and I think those guys out there can also be lucky. It's a case of, all right, having to push yourself, having to be a bit cheeky sometimes, but usually most people are quite understanding, quite willing to sort of listen to your point of view regarding work and anything else, and it's not bad at all that we have had our downsides, don't we all? And I came across a boss at one time that actually was that rude and was that nasty that he was taken out of a meeting by the union representative and my boss from Shaw Trust, because if he'd have said any more, I could have taken him to court for slander. He says, with people like him, we could be in dock for murder. Now, that's prejudice to the highest degree.
It certainly is. That's appalling.
I think it was, to be perfectly honest, Steve, I think it was fear more than anything. The guy actually got the kick, he got the boot. But he didn't know how to handle people. He didn't know how to face up to these things or sort of handle these things. And he was just in a panic. because he'd not gone into the facts. He'd not gone into the fact that I was probably monitored more closely than any member of staff that he had. But it's that sort of thing that we have to fight against. And, you know, I'd hate to sound terribly corny, guys, I really do, but there's an advert on TV in the UK, and it says, behind every disability, there's a person, and you know that's dead true.
That's a great philosophy, Dave, and I admire you tremendously for sticking at your job after an awful remark like that, because I think some people it would have put off, but not Dave, obviously. Dave, can I thank you very much indeed for sharing your life with us, and if there's anyone who would like to ask a question of Dave about anything he's spoken about, I'm sure he'd be willing to answer. But on behalf of everyone here, Dave, thanks very much indeed, and it's been a great pleasure to talk to you.
Thanks very much, Steve. I really enjoyed it. There's so much I'd have liked to have covered. I had my electronic reminder here, my parrot, with all the things that I wanted to bring up, and I've not mentioned half of them. But I hope it's not been too boring, and I'm quite willing to answer any questions at all, apart from how much money I've got in my bank balance.
That's going to be my first question. Can I borrow a tenner? Okay, anybody got any questions for Tom Anna?
Sheltered employment scheme, how does that go on? A salary, does it give you a basic salary? And if so, do they base it to the proper wage scale that you should be getting within your job, or is it set at a lower rate?
Now that's one thing I wanted to emphasise to Steve before, and thanks very much, Chris, for bringing it up, because it's very, very important, this. Very important. As a medical technical officer, doing the same line of work as my colleagues, although that line of work is assisted and helped by cash from outside, equipment for outside, I'm still doing the same job of work. And in this day and age, the quality being what it should be, yes. In fact, I am actually I've just been nominated for a promotion. That should come through in the next couple of months. But yes, Chris, you get the same salary. If you don't, the company are committing an illegal act.
Cool, okay. Only I've seen sort of sheltered employment schemes that have gone the way of you sit in the corner, put nuts and bolts in a packet, you sit there and earn your minimum sum every week. And no matter if you've got higher up the scale, you still earn the same money. And I've seen that in a number of cases. So I didn't know whether wage scale went up or down with it. Maybe Dave will tell you what he does lightning count. He's a technician.
Okay, Chris, one thing I must emphasise to all the guys out here, in the UK anyway, by law, your salary is supposed to be looked at every 2 years. And every 2 years, if the company turns around and says, well, in my particular case, they look at my job output, my work output, amount of hours, and so on and so forth, and if you are doing a job, which in my case is quite involved, and in another case, if the amount of work I'm doing matches in any way the same as the normal sighted or impaired person, not counting the extra time or equipment, because that is, if somebody says, well, I can do this quicker than you can, I don't wish to get on my politically correct horse here, but you know, it's a form of prejudice. In other words, it's not proper anymore. The personnel department at Traffic General, where I work, of course, had a notice a couple of years back stating this fact, and it is not legal now to pay a disabled person less, assumed that they are doing the job the same as a fully sighted person. If, for instance, a disabled person is doing a job, and because of one form or another, they are unable to do the tasks in a certain time, that is no longer relevant. I do advise people, you've got rights, stick to them. I know for a fact that my boss has come over to me and he actually said to me, Dave, he said, if I don't keep your salary in line with your colleagues, he said, I'm up for a kick in the rear end.
Are all these rules and regulations set out in a document under access to work, Dave, or is it just they're just particularly your firm or company or authority that you work for is sticking to that, or is there something actually written down in writing under law that we can all get a hold of, a statement or a piece of legislation that we can read and know our rights in this regard? Yeah.
Okay, Chris. Every personnel department in every company in the land, assuming that they're not crooks, should have a copy of this, and you can make them aware of it. In fact, I didn't even know that it had existed. So there you go. Don't be put on, gang. You're entitled to the salary befitting to the job of work that you do. And there you go. So I better stop because I'm getting on the iron box.
Do you compete with sighted people for the same jobs as they do? You do, correct? And on that note, how hard is it to deal with employers in proving to them that you are capable of handling the job as much as anyone else? And how willing are employers to, like, assist you in getting what you need to complete the task? I believe they said you're a technician, so you work computers, and are they very willing to get, like, speech software, whatever you might need? Or is that a struggle, too? Curious.
Yeah, okay, I've got the gist of that. Right, okay, let me give you an example. My employees, in fact, they're going to say to SureTrust, the people at pay the other part of my wages. Right, now, we've got to know, obviously, Dave's technical capabilities. So they give me a job to do, and they give my colleague the same job. Okay? So let's say for talking's sake that, let's say I have to re-gasket a particular piece of equipment. So I take the cylinder head off. I then take up the bolts, take off the gaskets, the old gaskets, dispose of them, put the new blades on the gaskets. I do it, and then my colleague does it, and then they ask my boss and the colleague who showed me how to do it or whatever, and they say, well, like, okay, is Dave capable of doing that? Yeah, no problem. If you have a problem, you try and get around it. If the problem is that you cannot do it at all, then we sort of think, well, okay, perhaps you can do something else that a colleague can do easier, and he could take that off you. It's a case of really, it sounds worse than it is, but if you're working with the right sort of people, and of course, because it's sheltered, as in, like I say, you are looked at by the help at work people, the shelter employment people, in my case, your trust, professional people, and of course, your own first line boss. If he thinks that you can't do something, of course, they would tell you. And if you can't, we would try and get a way around it. And if not, well, we try and do something else. Within the capabilities, within the jobs that you're doing. I hope I've explained that okay to you.
How hard is it to get into a workplace dominated otherwise by all-sighted people? Like, how hard is it to get your way into a working place?
He wants to know how easy it was to get the job in the first place, Dave.
Ah, cheers, Chris. Yeah, sorry about that. I'm sorry, I didn't... I was having a job to hear him there. It kept going on and off. How to get the job in the first place? Well, I must admit, in my particular situation, it was being in the right place at the right time. And because the people who knew me knew I had certain qualifications, that also helped. But, like I say, when you, in our particular case, in the UK here, if you approach the sort of help at work people in the sort of job agencies, they will put you in touch with these people that can assess this and put you in a job of work that is appropriate to your qualifications or whatever you're capable of doing.
They also ask, what is sheltered employment as well, Dave?
Hi, Chris. Yeah, I do apologise to our friend. I just, sheltered employment is doing a job of work. You're employed by the employer. In my particular case, it's the health service. But you are also looked over, both financially, legally, and supported by a trust or a company that is very much like your sponsor. Your sponsor. And you then give up looking, you then sort of, because you're disabled, you then give up sort of the right to look for work by yourself, which could be not the right type of job. In other words, you then say to these people, right, can you find me work? Can you put me in the right placement? And this is the way it works. They look for work for you, for the type of work that you are able and capable to do.
Well, yes, I'm over in the USA, so we have nothing like that, really. You basically, it's like, they give you training when you're younger, and, like, when you're in college and stuff. The Commission for the Blind here does, to get yourself, to be able to go out and get a job, and other than that, you're on your own, which I actually would prefer, honestly, but, yeah. I mean, I don't know, I have a lot of faith in myself, so. Okay, well, thank you very much for answering my question.
Of course, sheltered employment used to be under the sheltered workshop schemes, didn't it? It just used to apply to the workshops, so it's a lot broader footing these days. Is that right, Dave?
Yes, it is, Alan. It is Chris, actually, yes. And, of course, they've branched out now on the Help at Work Act, basically in the, sort of attached to your local job agencies. The other people, the trusts or whatever particular organisation supports your job of work. In my particular case, it just happens to be a place of people called Sure Trust. There are a number of trusts that do this sort of support work. And of course, the main thing is it's putting somebody who's disabled back into a job of work, putting something back into the community. So, for the system, it's far better to help a visually impaired person by supplying him with some computer equipment and software and so on, than it is to pay him, whatever he wishes to claim for.
Thanks a whole lot, Dave. This is Becky. It was a great interview.
Yeah, thanks, Becky. I'm sorry if I've not covered a lot of things, or may have not been quite as explicit as I perhaps meant to be, but I hope you've got the idea. I know it does vary from country to country and place to place, and sometimes we do get a raw deal. There's a mate of mine who's had a real raw deal from one company he worked for. He was really fed up, really down, and now he's working for a company. He's to do with one of the local radio stations, and he's absolutely great. He's well looked after. He gets on great with his colleagues. So it just goes to show.
Okay. Well, once again, Dave, thanks very much for sparing your time for us, and hope everyone's enjoyed it. Thanks once again.
Thank you, Steve.
Yeah, thanks, Steve. And like I say, I'm always knocking about. If anybody wishes to discuss these things, I can go into greater depth anytime regarding these subjects. I'm always knocking about, or you can drop me an email. And you can always drop me an email on Hotmail, my G0BJK, my radio amateur call sign. Just type in G0BJK at hotmail.com, and I shall send you my proper email address. And if you wish to go on MSN Messenger or talk on the chat room, I'm usually hanging about Fiddler's Green or whatever, I'll only be too pleased.